evening. My name is Clancy Emerson, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here. I've been coming to Santa Barbara off and on for 35 years, I guess. And I haven't saved you yet, but I'm going to try one more time. I saved a few guys, but they died. I'm glad to be here. I've brought a couple guests, companions with me. Not like Matt Johnson's companion. This is a different kind of companion. Russ Conchie, who is visiting, who's an AA leader in Brisbane, Australia. And next to him is Simon Rauch, who is the delegate from New Zealand to the International Convention. He just kept coming on his way back from New York. Stand up. Stand up. I allowed them to drive me here while I slept in the back seat. I'm glad to see many old friends and new friends. I was thinking when Keith, or is that your, are you Kevin? Keith, whoever you are, read tonight. That's one of the great miracles of AA. I look at Keith and his two brothers who are in this group and Keith in our group, and they look like they just stepped out of Slap Shop, the Hansen brothers in person in AA. And these guys, when they first came around, they were as goofy as they come. Just the three loose cannons with a crazed mother behind them going, Vel, you know. And now they're just all square as they can be. And their mother smirks and takes credit for it. Well, I'm sorry I missed Keith last night. I was at a different meeting talking, but I've always enjoyed Keith's talk from North Carolina. A good man, a good AA. And I know you had a good meeting, a series of good meetings today. Those of you who didn't run or play golf probably went to one or two of them. And I'm sure we'll have a good meeting tomorrow. But we're here, we gather like this to share our experience, strength, and hope about certain things that are quite universal to all of us. And when you come here, you know they're not universal, because if there's one feeling that most of us have had and will continue to have intermittently, it is, yes, this is all very good, but my case is different. I slipped in and out of AA year after year after year after year. And in all those times, I never had any question that AA worked. I've never known a long-term drinker who questions the fact that AA works. I've sat in bars with long-term slippers, and we all drank and said AA does work. But the caveat is always this: but for people like them, not for me. Because my case is different. And that's a terrible cry. You know, in the last month, I've had kind of an exotic series of Saturday nights. Last Saturday night, I was talking in some place called Rock Springs, Wyoming, to a bunch of cowboys. And the week before that, I was talking in Naples, Florida. The week before that, in Nassau in the Bahamas. The week before that, in Costa Rica. And you think these would be all divergent in various things. But if you listen to chatter before you in the meeting, you hear the same things, the same feelings, the same. Some people are doing well, some people aren't doing well, some people don't know if they should be there or not, some people think that their pain is unusual. And it's really an amazing thing that these young guys from Australia and New Zealand, I've been to their meetings down there, and I've had the opportunity over the past few years to, because I've been sober a long time and I'm active a long time, the last few years I've talked in exotic places like Cape Town, South Africa, and Johannesburg, and Berlin, and Amsterdam, and London, and all over Ireland, and places like Paris. And you'd really think that there would be exotic aid, different AA, but it really isn't. Except for the accents, you hear the same things you hear here. And it's really a remarkable thing, because AA is quite simple, and it's easy to accept once you can accept it. But it's very hard to get to a point where you can accept it. I was talking to Keith tonight at the table about, it's a strange thing. It's almost, you know, in the church they talk about how some people, when you become converted to the church, that the Holy Ghost comes down, a tongue of fire, an invisible tongue of fire lands on your shoulder, and you become converted to the work of the church. And in a real sense, it almost seems like that way in somehow in AA. Five people can sit in the meetings, the same, hear the same words, do the same things, have the same speakers, have the same sponsor even. And a couple of them make it, and two or three of them don't. And who can figure out why? It's almost as though their tongue of fire missed them and dropped somewhere else. And they have no idea why not, And nobody else says, you might do, why not? One of the great heartaches, if you could call it a heartache, it is at first, but after a while you get used to dealing, working with people, of being a sponsor, is so many times the people that you really want to stay sober don't. And some of the people you just, yeah, I'm glad you're here, stay sober. Now, and it turns out that they become some of the better members of AA. Who can explain that? I look back and think, why is it so difficult? And I think there are people like me. In our book, we talk about alcoholics of our type. And I've come to believe over the years that I'm of that type that they describe in the book. I think there are different types of alcoholics, perhaps, because there seem to be alcoholics who have trouble drinking. And one day they seem they're having trouble drinking, and they stop drinking. And said, well, I'm not going to do that anymore. It really screws me up. And that's the end of that. Then there are other people who have trouble drinking, but they've kind of become addicted to it physiologically. They need to be taken off. That's why we have places like Chic Chadel up in Seattle, and maybe some of these other treatment centers where you go and you're physically removed from alcohol, and you get off and say, boy, that stuff ate me up. I'm not going to drink that anymore. And that's the end of that. And then there's the other type, which we call alcoholics of our type, who have trouble drinking, sometimes addicted, sometimes not, and laboriously come off alcohol and find that sobriety becomes more painful than drinking. And much to the consternation of their friends and family and loved ones, eventually they drink again, and they must get off drinking again, and then they must drink again, and they get off drinking again. And I'm sure if you could slice open their hearts, they would all have engraved, but I'm not really an alcoholic. You don't understand. My problems came when I was sober. I drank to get some relief, and I got a little out of hand. And they never know, as I never knew, I'm sure most of you never knew, that is the nature of the battle we face here. We don't face the battle of drinking. Drinking is easy to beat. If drinking was the problem, detoxes would turn out winners. The problem is we are facing a problem called sobriety. And that's why so many of us think, but I'm an AA and I've got off the drinking and I have all these terrible problems. I must be different. And they have no idea. That is what makes them stay here. That is why they are here. I spent much of my early life with, I'm sure most of you have, discovering that alcohol got me through situations and made me feel ways that nothing else did. I heard something on the radio the other day, I don't know if I can say it right. It's just an amusing thing. They talk about how women hold men, or why men sometimes change women. It's not what the women are so much, it's how they make the men feel. If they make the men feel like there's something, that's how you get them. And if they make you, if you take it for granted, eventually you don't. Now, I'm sure that's true for men, for women. But it's the same thing. I identified that as that's what alcohol does for me. Alcohol takes a person like me, who of myself for many years was, always felt like in some kind of way there was something missing in me. Didn't know what it was, but other people seemed to recognize there was something missing in me, because when they got close to me, pretty soon they didn't like me, seemed to me, and I didn't know why. And so I tried not to get close to people. I look back now and I realize why in my life I could not sustain close relationships. And the reason is this, because insecure people like me, and maybe like some of you, in order for me to feel normal, I've got to insist you treat me special. All I ask of people, just treat me special all the time, and I'll feel average. I never realized I was doing that, but I demand it of people. And if you treat me average, pretty soon I feel rejected. And I'll tell you, nowhere in the world are you going to find people that treat you special all the time. It's just after a while they don't do that. They accept you and treat you average. And pretty soon, now, that's why people like me have to change bars and change jobs and change cities and change loves and change things. Someone who will make me feel like something. And I discovered when I was a young man, alcohol, it takes away that feeling of not feel like I'm quite enough. When I have a few drinks, I feel like I'm more than enough. Who Who cares what you think? Four eyes. Yeah. Much of my life I've lived with a lot of fear. Fear, not so much fear of pain, although I have that too, but fear of exposure. Fear that people will see I'm not enough, and I got to keep walls up all the time and pretend to be something and trying to be hip-slick and cool or clever or smart. To live behind a wall of defense mechanisms. Never realized, you know, I used to think I'm the only one who has to do that. But later I discovered every human being has defense mechanisms because nobody fills their armor. No human being does. But for people like me, and maybe some of you, my whole life is a role. It's just not a role. It's a series of roles. What does she want? What does this boss want? What does this woman want? What is this? It just changed like a chameleon. Boom, boom. Hip, slick, and cool. Demure, sweet, intellectual, just bang, 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 bang. And I always afraid that people are going to see through me and you realize I'm nothing. So I keep an arm's length as much as possible. And always that fear. But when I have a few drinks and it's working, I become fearless a lot of times. I don't care what anybody thinks. I'm not afraid of anything. I fight cops. Come on, clever. You know? I jump off balconies in swimming pools. Don't have a swimming pool? I'll jump on your lawn. Shit, makes no difference to me. You know? It takes a person like me who's insecure enough to be so afraid of public humiliation and rejection. But I'm feeling bad. But I've seen times I would not ask my wife to dance. Because I might know that she's busy doing something and she'll say, oh, not right now. And I know that people will hear that and they'll say, oh, she wouldn't even dance with him. Afraid to ask, you know, or I have a few drinks, it's all different. The best way I know to describe this, I must have said this 1,000 times, I don't know a better way to describe it. I'm sure it's happened to a lot of guys in this room. Sitting in a bar late at night, having a few drinks, thinking how they're screwing you around, brown nosers down to work, are elbowing you out of position. People are all crapheads anyway. You have a few drinks, and suddenly you notice a miracle take place in front of your eyes, little by little. You watch some old beast gradually become beautiful. I might sidle over such an old queen at closing time. Imply there will be delights beyond her comprehension. Would you like to join me in the old Chevy? Now she would say, now? God, if I were sober, I'd cut my wrists right there. But I wouldn't be there asking the question if I were sober. But I've had a few drinks. I don't feel rejected. I feel sorry for her. Too bad, bitch, don't come begging tomorrow. That and several other things like that is why I drink. I don't drink because I'm a drinker. I drink it because I need it to feel the way other people seem to feel normally. There's something missing in my makeup, but I discover as the years went by, I start to drink too much. And then people think I have a drinking problem. But I was a young man. I was some friends of our family sent me to AA. They didn't know what it was, but there was something to do with drinking, so I went for the hell of it. And I went to my first AA meeting in 1949. That's a long time ago. A lot of you little snots weren't even born. We love you. And it was a nice place, except there's old gray-haired fools sitting around saying, my problem is alcohol. It seemed to me they were saying things like, yes, I drank around the clock. One day I walked through that door, they told me to put the plug in the jug. And I did. And by God, I've just never felt so wonderful. You feel like, why don't you tell your face, you know. They stop bringing, they feel all right, but I'm not like that. I went to AA off and on for a while. I went to psychoanalysis because I realized my problems were different than theirs. I read books. I did a lot of things. I thought about my life. I thought about growing up. you know, I look about my life in psychoanalysis. I grew up in a nice home in a Midwestern small town. In a nice parents, raised in a very strict church, the Norwegian Lutheran Church, where you just learn to sing songs in Norwegian and become confirmed and catechized and inculcated with God's will, which is don't sin and stay away from Catholics. And I should have been something, you know, but as I grew up, I noticed it was anybody's fault, but just a quirk that I seem to be one of the few Lutherans who need more fun than others. So I got sinning and monkeying with Catholics and then sinning with Catholics, which was pretty easy when I think about it. And I always used to, I know it's going to go to hell, but that wasn't it. I discovered I was 15, I ran away from home early in the Second World War, sitting on a ship in Pearl Harbor, that a few drinks of alcohol made me feel like a grown-up. And there's nothing wrong with that, except a number of years later, after a lot has happened to me, I had my last drink in Skid Row, with everything gone, my home gone, my family, my teeth kicked out. And I look back and I think it's safe to say, I took my last drink because I wanted to feel grown-up. Now, it's nothing to feel, nothing wrong to feel grown up when you're 15 years old. When you're getting old and wrinkled and bald, you better make your move soon, because you're not going to have much lot of time to be grown up. And all these years I went to AA intermittently. And I had good sponsors in some cities. And I went to AA in Chicago and Dallas, San Francisco, and a lot of places where I was working, because I was a writer in an advertising agency. And after the war, I'd taken some tests in the Navy, so I was able to get a high school diploma, honorary high school diploma, enabled me to go to college after the war, 1946. In fact, 2 months ago, I guess, I went back to Wisconsin, and they had the 50th anniversary of the entering class of 1946, which is one of the few classes they'll ever have that. And the reason they did that is because it was such an esoteric class. A lot of guys were going to college on the GI Bill who never would have gone to college. So you had a 35-year-old freshman and 18-year-old sophomores, and just strange. And went back there and saw all these old, some of these old guys were really old boobs now, but it's good to see them. And it was exciting to think about those days. But I went to college. I became a, when I got out of college, In college, I made one of my first mistakes. I married this Catholic girl because I thought she was exotic, because nobody in the Lutheran Church had black hair that I could see, as she did. And she was a good Catholic girl, and she had the... There's something you never tell Lutheran boys. If you marry a good Catholic girl, you're about to have a big family, whether you plan to or not. And I used to plead with her, but it just... I became a national distributor of small Catholics, and just boom, boom, boom. I think about that now, how times have changed. I remember saying to her, can't we use birth control? And she said, no. And if she had said yes, I'd know what the hell I'd have done. Because I'll tell you something, in the late 1940s, it took some kind of guy with some kind of waivers to walk in and order condoms. It was a word you never heard. Maybe rubbers sometimes, but you wouldn't order those either, you know. You'd hire some ne'er-do-well, rotten guy, and even he would go in and say, I'd like some cigarettes and some rubbers. Now it's all different, of course. There's at least the thrifty drug down on Lincoln Boulevard, at least the ones I see, they come in and say, hey, I want some condoms and some cigarettes. You know, it's a change in the thrust somehow of society. But my first job out of college, I was a sports writer, newspaper sports writer, which is still my favorite job I ever had. But we had more children. I had gotten advertising and public relations and worked in corporations. And all these years, drinking was the greatest help I had. And I just had a credit. I went to AA when I lost control to take the heat off. And after a number of years of doing this, I knew what AA was. I knew it very well. I had good sponsors. And everybody in this room knows what AA is. But it doesn't help people like me. Because the purpose of AA is this. You go there, and you admit your problem is alcohol, and you stay sober. And you return to God, and then you show your gratitude by helping others. and then you lead a good life. And I went to AA again and again, and I knew these things had no help for me, and I tried them a little bit and they didn't work. And it may work for people whose problem is drinking, but not for people whose problem is thinking. And the last day of my drinking, I found myself two big guys throwing me out of a Skid Row mission in Los Angeles and saying, "Stay out of here, you damn troublemaking bum." And I tried to explain to them, "I'm not a damn bum. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I helped write were the running ad very weak in Life and Time and Serving Post and LC Downwards for the board and company. I've had my picture in the New York Times for achievement." How many people do you know have had their picture in the New York Times for achievement? It's kind of hard to explain these things in midair. You know, you're sore across that. And some guy had kicked my front teeth out in the Phoenix jail about 3 weeks before, so I had no front teeth. And I had my clothes covered with vomit, so there was a credibility problem we had. When I stood outside of that mission, the midnight mission in Los Angeles, in a cold, rainy morning, cold drizzle, and I was sick. And I'd been down before, but I was bounced up. This time I didn't bounce back up, first time ever. And if a man would have come over to me that morning and said, "Hey, Slim, you know, you're getting close to death. You're down to almost 100 pounds. You've lost your clothing. You've lost your wife and children. You'll never see them again. You had such a great career opportunity, and you just ruined it. There's no place you can go back to, any place you've ever been. No one will talk to you just about. You've broken their hearts. Your own mother, you're an only child, and your mother's not allowed to accept collect phone calls from you because they can't stand to watch your hopes get up one more time and then dashed again. Why don't you just admit you're an alcoholic, for God's sakes, and do something about it?" And if my life depended on it, and I believe it did, I'd have had to say, "But it isn't the way it looks. I wish stopping drinking and being an alcoholic would correct it, but it doesn't. You don't understand." And he might have said, "Well, prove you're not an alcoholic." I would not have had the objectivity to be able to stand back and explain it then, so I wasn't able to get enough objectivity about myself with anything. So I probably would have had to do what people like me who are afraid and inadequate and insecure do, which is take refuge behind bluster. And say to me, "Oh, get out of my face. Screw you. Leave me alone." So I wouldn't have known the answer. But I know the answer now. I've been sober a long time, and I've been AA a long time, and I look back and I understand why I felt that way and was willing to bet my life on it. Because I knew that I was not the way an alcoholic was. But no one came over and talked to me in that street corner that morning, and I was cold and sick, and I had no place to turn. I didn't know anybody in Los Angeles. I remember a guy had taken me a week before off the street drunk and taken me to an AA club where I denounced them and raped all their goofs. And but I knew I had to get off the street. I knew how to hustle AAs, I felt. And so I walked. I found out, all I remember was Wilshire and Fairfax, wherever the hell that is. And I found a way to get to Wilshire. And then they said, "Just go west till you come to Fairfax." And I walked and walked in that cold rain. And I don't know if I'd be able to walk it today in good health, but when you're desperate, you can do a lot of things. Turned out to be 72 blocks from the mission out there. And I got to that club and I walked in and they recognized me and they weren't glad to see me. And I wasn't glad to see them. Not only was it an AA club, but it was full of AA fanatics. I don't know anything more distressing for an intelligent slipper than to find himself amongst those simpleton AA fanatics. God, they're a dreary bunch. I'll tell you how to describe it. I'll tell you an example. Now, I'm not a mooch. I've never been a mooch, except I've had to be. But I probably gave them a clue how they could help me if they didn't know. I have no place to stay. I've lost my clothing. I'm cold and wet. I have no place to change. I have nothing to change into. I'm hungry. And I'm sick. And I'm desperate. And if I just had a place to stay, maybe a couple square meals, some dry clothes, I bet I could really work this program and do the 12 steps. You know, that would seem to be kind of an indication how you can help, huh? Do you know what any fanatics say? They say, "Go to a lot of meetings, work the steps, it'll all work out." And of course the answer to that is, oh gee sir, you're number one with me. And I hung around that club that night. I slept in an abandoned car in the parking lot. Little did I know I'd be sleeping in that car for a long time. I had no idea that would be the beginning of my sobriety. I didn't want it to be the beginning of my sobriety. I was in hell. Now last Wednesday night in my home group in Los Angeles, my granddaughter came up and gave me a cake with 38 candles on it. And now I'm just an old little old fuddy-duddy formal right-wing fascist AA pig. And I don't understand you suckers. You should have been around the old days when we were sincere. And I look back now, and I'm sure there are people in this room and people... Is this camera on? People down in the half measures room? They'll never find me. I'll be out of here like a rocket after this meeting. I look back and I think to myself, how did I stay sober? I stayed sober because I was surrounded by fanatics and because I got a sponsor, but I had to have a change in philosophy. Now, how could I be an alcoholic? I didn't believe I was an alcoholic until I was sober sometime, but how could I be an alcoholic? I'm sure there are people in this room who say, yes, but I'm not an alcoholic. How could I be an alcoholic when my problem really isn't alcohol? It is when I'm drunk, and I look like I'm a drunkard, but it isn't. I have much different emotions and problems and feelings and remorses and sadnesses and depressions and things. I am glad that I survived long enough and fell into the hands of fanatics and a sponsor to come to, I think this is the number one tenet for people to stay sober today, to somehow survive here long enough to discover that that is absolutely correct. Your problem is not alcohol. If it is, you don't need to be here. If it is, all you have to do is get sober at Chick Shadell or on your bed, and you're home free. And that's the hardest thing to come to understand, because they keep talking about, when I'm sober, it's all right. When I'm getting sober, since I've been sober, it's wonderful. And you sit there just in desperation. And that's one of the, I look back now and I understand why I knew I wasn't an alcoholic in that street corner. Because I knew that I'm not like them. I knew what an alcoholic is. An alcoholic is a person who drinks too much. Eventually their emotions get screwed up, their lives get painful, and they're driven to someplace like AA, and the AA's get them sobered up and clean up their act, and they live happily ever after. Or better anyway. And I went to meetings all over the country, it seems to me. I heard that. And I stood in the corner, I'll tell you, and I would have bet my life if I had the opportunity. I'm not like that. And I wish I were. I wish I were like that. But I'm not. It's almost as though I'm some kind of a reverse AA alcoholic. Some kind of a negative to a positive. Unlike alcoholics, it is when I stay sober and try to clean up my act, that is when my bad times come. And the longer I try to be good, the worse it gets. And finally it gets so bad, I have to have a few drinks to stand it. And I don't drink because I'm a drinker. I drink to feel the way alcoholics seem to feel when they get sober. And sometimes I drink too much. And then people say again, oh, you ought to go to AA. They get sober and they'll find the answer. And I say, thanks for the advice, but inside me a visceral voice just wants to shriek, but you don't understand. It doesn't work for people like me. There's something wrong inside of me. But you can't say that, so you just go about your business. I'm glad that I survived long enough here to learn the great lesson. And I heard it from people that didn't believe it, and maybe the people in this room will hear it from me and not believe it. But you must try to believe it. That, as I said in my start tonight, that is exactly true. The problem here is not alcohol. If you think it is, you die from it. The problem here is something that sounds like alcohol, and we keep thinking it's alcohol, but it's entirely different. It is something called alcoholism. Of course, you say, well, same thing. Not the same thing. Significantly different. I'll guarantee you, if you'd be like me, the day will come in your life when your sanity and existence will depend on remembering the difference. Now, there's a lot of differences, but there's support in one sentence. An alcohol problem is overcome by stopping drinking and cleaning up your act and determining to stop. That's one of those first two types of alcoholics. But this strange, deadly, emotionally destroying thing called alcoholism, you'll discover sooner or later, if you haven't discovered it yet, if you are like me, an alcoholic of our type. Staying sober and cleaning up your act has no significant long-term result other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it. That's what makes alcoholism a fatal disease. If getting sober is the answer, there would never be a death from alcoholism. But it's after getting sober, eventually getting so painful that the memory of drinking is preferable to what I'm going through. Well, that sounds pretty simple, but one other thing must be present, it turns out. Even that doesn't make you an alcoholic, that just prepares you. The other thing is, you must be one of the 7 or 8 or 9% of people in the world who get an unnatural reaction to alcohol. And you say, well, okay, but you never know it's an unnatural reaction. You have no way of knowing it. Nobody does. You have nothing to compare it against. It's like saying, I'm getting strawberries have an unnatural taste to me. Nobody can say that because they don't know how they taste other people. I know what alcohol is. I always assumed that alcohol had the same effect on other people as it did for me. It made them feel bigger and stronger and better and more complete. And if they didn't drink the way I felt, it indicated they didn't need to. They felt that way all right. And I never knew that that was an unnatural effect. It's kind of a funny thing about that unnatural effect. When this book was written, many of the people in AA at that time, those first 87 people who were sober a year, were people who drank for several years and then crossed an invisible line and beginning getting that unusual effect. That's why they talk in the book about some people returning to normal living, who had grown up, made an adjustment to life, and then drank themselves out of adjustment. But today, as we know, most of alcoholics and Alcoholics Anonymous are people who never had made an adjustment. They are, in a part of them, children when they're gray-haired old men and women. So that makes this kind of strange dichotomy you find in AA sometimes. You find some old fool gets up there and says, I drank for 35 years before I came to AA. And they look accusingly at some little snot who looks old, about 25, as if to say, how could you be an alcoholic, you little snot? I drank longer than you lived. And what they don't realize, the little snot looking up and thinking, you can't be much of an alcoholic if you lasted 35 years, you old son of a bitch. You know. It turns out it isn't how long you drank, it's when it begins to do that for you, have that unnatural effect, to change your perception of reality, to make it different. And if it does that, eventually it has to become a problem. And then you return to sobriety, and that's a problem. And eventually you return to drinking, and that's a problem. And eventually you return to sobriety, and that's a problem. And that's called alcoholism. And today in America, where there's more sobriety than anywhere in the history of the world, it is estimated that about 95% of alcoholics still die drunk, or as a direct result of drinking. Safe to say a number of people in this room will die drunk. Not because AA doesn't work, but because they'll stop doing it. Maybe me, maybe you. I know my sponsor taught me that many years ago, and I thought he's trying to frighten me. But a few years later, when he stopped doing AA and died drunk, it convinced me he meant what he said. But the problem here is this. I've got to realize that my case is not different because I feel my sobriety is untenable. That is exactly what the first step says. You don't come here and admit your alcohol problem is out of control. You admit that you become powerless over alcohol. And also, dash, English language, end of thought, beginning of new thought, my life has become unmanageable, for I'm sober. If stopping drinking is the answer for your pal, you're wasting your time here. But if you're an alcoholic of our type, the chances are terribly high you will go to your grave unless you do something about it. So I eventually came to understand stopping drinking and being sober won't make you better. The goal of AA is not being sober. Being sober is the entrance to AA. It's what happens after that that changes it. And eventually you may go through some steps. So you do things if you get someone that you can trust to be your sponsor. But then if you're like me, you come upon that other cropper. Returning to God. I cannot return to God. I joke about it, but if God exists, I am damned. I am damned. And I can joke and laugh about it, but it's not funny at all. You wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning and say, I'm damned. And there's no way out. Remember I was at a meeting in Chicago one day, and I was trying to explain this, that I can't return to God. God is just terrible. And this woman came up, and she said, oh, son, she said, some nice little lady, she said, I just hate to see you fight God. And I was thinking, it's all I can do to keep from saying, well, ma'am, you'll never see me fight God again. Now you can hear me fight God for a while. But if God exists, I am damned. I was like Nietzsche, Friedrich Nietzsche, one of the philosophers I read and didn't completely understand. But one of his great treatises that I loved, he said, one of his characters says, God is dead. Why are you concerned about God? God perhaps existed once to set the orbs of the world, to set the natural law. But there's no God. Look at the anarchy about you in every nation, in every city, in every society. There is no God. There's natural law that is being denied that every step. I remember reading that thinking, Jesus, that's good news. You know. If that's true, I got a fighting chance, you know. But of course, sooner or later we undo that. There's a very famous theological seminary in Chicago where they quote that on the wall, a big sign says, God is dead. Signed Friedrich Wilhelm Nietzsche, 1884. And beneath it, it says, Nietzsche's dead, signed God, 1906. You know. But this time when I came to AA and I was surrounded by these fanatics and doing things, and I had this spot, and the sponsor started grinding me about, he said, I heard you talk at the discussion meeting. Somebody told me about what you said at the discussion meeting. You try not to get a sponsor that has spies everywhere. Here's what he said now. He said, why don't you stop making a fool of yourself and not talking about... I said, I cannot return to God. And he pointed out to me rather profanely, I wouldn't quote him because I'm not that type of guy. But he said, you don't have to return to God for Christ's sake. It says you come to believe. You don't return to nothing in AA. Because it's all sick where you're coming from. You come to believe in something. Can't you believe in God? I said, no, I can't. He says, can't you believe in AA? I said, it doesn't work with people like me. He says, you think I'm doing better than you are? I said, I guess so. He says, congratulations, I'm your new higher power. And he became my higher power. Remember people around that club laughing about it. Look at that silly bastard. He's got a sponsor. He thinks his sponsor's God. My sponsor was mean, but he couldn't send me to hell. I could accept that. And I did things to please that old puke I wouldn't have done for anybody, you know, just to get him off my case. And eventually I took actions that were stupid and dumb. That's one of the great things about being around AA fanatics, incidentally. I wouldn't call them fanatics now. I call them winners. But if you're going to do that, they say, stick with the winners. The question is, who's the winners? Is the ones who've been sober the longest? Nah. To our old timers in AA, I wouldn't hire to mow my lawn. Just, I love them, but I don't like them, come to think about it. I'll tell you who the AA winners are, in my opinion. They are the people who are currently involved in AA, who are doing the things, who are going to meetings, who are trying in their limited, stupid way to be of service to God and man, which is all we do. And the reason you stay with the winners is because they're activists, and they're doing things, and occasionally they joggle your sick head out of the way. I remember standing in that club and thinking, I'll never see my children again. I've lost everything. I'm sober, but it's just hideous. What am I going to do? And just as I was working up ahead of steam, one of these boobs said, come on, time to go to the meeting. Give me the car, Clancy. I think I'll convince you of that. Come on, I'm going to help Fred move his furniture. Nobody knows the problems I've seen, and I don't even believe in Jesus. Come on! I'm going to help a guy get his first sober first birthday. Just on and on till you're crazy. But just survive. Survive long enough to get a sponsor. And I had this sponsor, and I was active. I didn't want to be, but I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I didn't know the things. And I came to believe in my sponsor because I thought he was doing me. I resented him much of the time. He embarrassed me, humiliate me. He didn't, I don't know if he did it intentionally. I hope not. I thought he probably just an accident. But yeah, he'd say things to me like at a meeting, at a coffee break where people could hear him. Go and apologize to that woman. Oh, should I? I was told you called her a bitch. I said, well, she is a bitch. Nobody cares what you think. You want to apologize. I look over there like, she's listening to all this. And she's going... I'd rather have the needle stuck in my eyes. I will not do that. I'm not sold out. I begin to tell him this, and he's looking at me, glaring at me and intimidating me, and I just told him, I said, sorry, you bitch. Go to that Tuesday night meeting in Central Hollywood.
Oh, Jesus, Bob, not that one. They're all weirdos there. Some of the men dress like women. Some of the women dress like men. There's an Arab there with a beer noose.
The guy that plays Dracula goes to that meeting. Bela Lugosi, if you fall asleep, he'll suck blood out of your neck.
They're weirdos, Bob.
You'll fit right in. Go to the goddamn meeting. And on. But little by little I took actions, and much to my surprise, although I didn't realize it except much in retrospect, I began to feel better. It didn't seem I was feeling better, just everybody else was shaping up a little bit. And eventually I came to believe in my sponsor, and I came to believe in AA. But I could not come to believe in God because of one word, and I heard it again and again. People said, I owe my sobriety to God's grace. That's very nice. But what about all the people who can't stay sober? I guess God doesn't give them grace. If God wants me to stay sober, if God's grace is like this, you can stay sober, you can't, you can, you too can, you can, this table can't, I will not be able to stay sober because I am not worthy of sobriety according to the church. How can you depend on God's grace and you walk through the streets and you see people dying on the street? Why, where's their grace for Christ's sake? How about that? If I had that same feeling today, I'm in a different situation than I've been much of my life. When I go to work in the morning, I step over the bodies of dying men and women sometimes to get to my office, dying of alcoholism. And I come out of my office sometimes and I step over the bodies of dying men and women to go. Where's their grace? Where's the grace of the man Wednesday who smashed his head into the sidewalk in convulsions in front of our building? Where's the grace of the man who they found Tuesday in the outdoor toilet with a knife in his ribs stuck in there? Where's God's grace for these people? How can you put your faith in God's grace? It's nice for those that got it. But if you haven't got it, you don't have much luck. And eventually I kept doing things, but I could not accept God. I accepted AA and my sponsor. And I listened to a lot, I went to a lot of meetings. I listened to some great old guys, Chuck Chamberlain and Paul Guilfoyle and Bob White and a lot of great speakers. And they've been to little by little work on me by the actions I was taking. I eventually wrote an inventory the day I was going to commit suicide. My sponsor intimidated me into writing an inventory. And a week later, he intimidated me to reading it to him. We went along the ocean with a flashlight and on, but I was holding little jobs, held them a little bit longer, sometimes a week, sometimes 2 weeks, get fired for my attitude, my bad mouth. But I could not make that hurdle into God's grace. And somewhere along the line, I don't know when it happened, I remember years ago telling some new people I was working with, that the greatest thing that ever happened to me at AA, one of the great things, in addition to finding out I was an alcoholic, was to come to understand for me a realization of how God's grace works in my life. Now, how can you say that when there's so many people dying? Where's their grace?
I think the analogy that finally appeared in my head, and in a sense, what all else fails, is there today. But I have a little more sophisticated understanding, I think, of God. It was this. I equated God's grace with, like Shakespeare equated rain. It falls on the just and the unjust. And everybody gets God's grace, I have come to believe. But then why don't we all respond to it? And the analogy I think of is that it's like Channel 4 in Los Angeles, or Channel 2. It, all day long, it sends out a picture, clear, as sharp as a bell, perfect sound, perfect color, perfect picture, to all televisions all over Los Angeles. It doesn't care if you have a Mitsubishi TV set, or an old GE TV set, or a Sony TV set, it's just sending you that picture. And in a real sense, people like me, many times go to their graves without learning how to turn on the dials, how to dial. And I had to understand why those dials worked, and I never could. And I came to realize, it's very much like when I'm watching football, when my grandchildren were a little smaller, watching a football game on Sunday afternoon, and I'd go to the washroom or get a cup of coffee or something, and these little rats would run through and turn all the knobs, and I'd come back and I became quite a wizard of that. I just, horizontal hole makes that baby straighten up, and the vertical hole stops the picture, and the tint gives it off blue faces, and okay, kids, you're grounded for the rest of your life. Yeah, great. And I have no idea what those knobs do with the TV set. I don't know what those nasty little electrons are doing dancing around in there. And let's make a funny picture. Nonsense. I don't know. All I know is when I turn that knob, the picture gets clearer. And in a real sense, I came to understand for people like me, maybe like you, but I know for me, the actions of AA are the knobs I turn to get a picture of God's grace. Now you can call it serenity, peace of mind, if God's grace bothers you. It always bothered me for a long time. But I don't know of anyone who wouldn't like to have peace of mind from time to time. And I turn these knobs, and it doesn't say horizontal hold. It says something like prayer. I say a prayer. I could not convince anyone. I couldn't prove to you that any prayer I've ever said in my life, and I said a lot of them, ever got out of the room I was in. I don't know that God ever heard your prayer of mine. I have no idea if he ever did. But when I turn that knob, the picture gets a little clearer. And it says, try to be of service to someone. Stupid thing. I can't even take care of myself. But you turn that knob and the picture gets a little clearer. And there's a whole bunch of dumb things that sponsors and your friends tell you to do. And they're all gradations of this picture. So you say, well, that's very nice. When you get a really clear picture, then you should be able to watch it for the rest of your life. But not for me. Most people I know, it seems as though in some celestial joke, my TV set has been put on the back of a pickup truck. Every time I get that baby in shape, oh shit, is there no end to this? You know. But I came to believe that's what AA is about. It doesn't make me holy or wonderful or superior, or you have little thin blue lips and go by taverns and say, you're going to hell. Yeah. It's to enable me to get some kind of a picture of God's grace. And as I said earlier, 95% of people like me, and I presume like some of you, will go to their grave and never know that God's grace existed for them. And I may die drunk too, because it turns out, as our book says, I believe to be absolutely true. The maintenance of my sobriety is based upon the maintenance of my spiritual condition. Not my religious condition. Not the number of prayers I say or how many meditations I go through, but the spiritual conditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, as Dr. Bob defined them so well, and very difficult for selfish, self-motivated, lazy, intellectual, slothful people as myself. Love and service. As Dr. Bob said in that great talk, he said, let's not louse our program all up with Freudian complexes that may be of interest to the scientists, but have nothing to do with our work here. When reduced to the last, AA is love and service. And we all know what love is, and we all know what service is.
Then he said, we must never be too busy to stop and give a hand to the man behind us. Because none of us would be here if someone hadn't taken time to explain to us, to show us, to take us to a few meetings, to get us going. And yet so many of us, when we get here, think, I've got mine, screw them. And the third thing, he didn't say that, but I said that. And the third thing he said, of course, is so accurate and something I try to work on, and I'm very poor at it, but I try to do it. He says, let us guard that erring member, the tongue, and try to use it with kindness and understanding. And all of us have a tendency, because of our emotional makeup, sometimes to lash out and be hurtful and sharp and tough. But that's what A is about. And I know this. Sometimes I get tired of dialing that TV set, and I just rather have a bad picture for a while. Maybe it'll get better by itself. I don't know. Who knows? Maybe I'll sleep through two more meetings this week, you know. But it turns out that's how you do it. Of getting out of self, and none of us do it easily. I don't know about you, but to this day, I am convinced that basically, I am a loner. Left to my own devices, I withdraw. I would much rather be in a room with a book and a snack than talking to anybody in the world. Good luck, stranger, leave me alone. And everything I do apart from that, I have learned in AA of getting out, of simulating interest till you gain interest. You know, that phone rings in my office a lot now. People I sponsor, are trying to sponsor, and every fiber of my being just wants to say, oh, Mr. Emerson, not in today. He went home a long time ago. Don't know where he goes. You know, get off my back, you sick bastard. You know. But I find myself saying, because some people did it for me, yes, she did. Oh, as though anybody in the world gives a shit. Yeah. But that's what people did for me. I tell you, one of the great memories of my life is when I was 5 years sober in 1963, and I was in New York. I finally had a job, and I had front teeth at last, and I was making my move. And the World Service Office was kind of not very sophisticated. And you went up the elevator on 45th Street, and there was a reception desk, and right next to it, with the door open, was Bill Wilson. And so I kind of went to his door. I said, you got a minute, Bill? He said, sure, come in. He said, shut the door. And I sat down, and I was quite thrilled to be there in his presence. And I told him about my gratitude and what AA had done for me. And I think of the hour I spent in there, I must have talked 45 minutes. And I look back now, I just cringe. I can just see his face going, oh, that's nice. Oh, that's nice. And now, actually, I'm just telling him what AA is about, you know. Oh, that's nice. And I know how that is, because now I sit in my office, and after people go in about 45 minutes, I find myself saying, oh, that's nice. God, that's how Bill Wilson felt. Poor son of a bitch. But that's what AA is about. And I find when I do these knobs, my picture continues to get better. It gets worse and better and worse and better. But I'm a weak human being, and I'm an emotional human being. And I'm telling Keith tonight, I did not have a happy childhood, but it's sure been a long one. It's been running on. And I need AA to center me, because that's what AA is about. I go to AA not to become spiritually wonderful. I go to AA to center my life, to remember to dial those knobs. And since then, I've come firmly to believe that God's grace is for me. And I step over the bodies of dying men and women, and I believe that God's grace is as intense for them as it is for me. Once upon a time, I lay right there, dying. But somehow, I try to work with these people, and they say, no, I've tried AA, it doesn't work, leave me alone. I've never known any long-term drinker dying who does not believe that AA would work for them. And it's an amazing thing, this denial. You know, I've had three babies now that I sponsor over the years die of cancer in the UCLA hospital. long involved with cancer. And I hate it. I hate to go to the hospital, sit in that cancer ward. But that's what sponsors are supposed to do. But stop there after work and look at this Ramon or Sandra, whoever it might be, dying of cancer. But looking around, I remember sitting there watching my friend Ramon die day after day and watching the beds run and come in, that guy's dead, new guy here, my guy's dead, new guy here. And one day it struck me, just think, what would these guys in this ward do if I walked in and said, hey, got a deal for you. Would you come with me every night at 8 o'clock and meet some new people and drink some coffee and schmooze and laugh and have a good time and just do that every night and join in if I could cure your cancer? They would sign over their homes to you, their cars, everything they got. Take me, God, take me. The worst place I've ever been in, I think, psychologically at any rate, is the Los Angeles County Hospital Cherry Ward for AIDS. That may be as bad a place as there is in the world. Does it smell bad? It's clean, antiseptic. But you look in there, it's like going to Molokai and seeing the leper colony. They're all dying. They're never going to get better. Not only dying, but they've been thrown away by everybody. They're in the charity ward. Nobody gives a damn about it. And going to that ward, I was calling on a man in that ward, an alcoholic, who was trying to hold it together. And I look around that ward, and they're dying in open sores. And Jesus Christ, I thought to myself, what would these guys do if I said, hey, got a deal for you. Would you do a bunch of things, whether or not you believed in them? Would you try to write down a lot of things that have bothered you that you never told anybody, then read them to me? Would you try to, even though you don't believe in God, would you try to turn your will and your life over to something? AA or me or God or whoever? Would you go back to people who you've screwed around and hurt and say you're sorry even though you're embarrassed and don't want to do it? Would you do those things if I could cure your AIDS? They would crawl across the floor and lick your feet. God, take me, take me. But in that same hospital, you go down two floors to the alcoholic ward, and the man is laying there with his liver out to here, and his skin is yellow, his eyes are yellow, and he will not go to the AA meeting down the hall because he's not an alcoholic, really. And it's kind of funny, except you go back next month and he's dead, and there's a new guy in that bed saying he's not an alcoholic. Now, if guys can be 3 or 4 days away from death from alcoholism with their liver out to here, and they can prove they're not an alcoholic, you and I sure as hell can. And that's why it is imperative that we continue to take the spiritual principles of meetings and trying to be of assistance and acting better than you feel sometimes and trying to work with new people, whether or not you really like them or not is extraneous, but to take the actions that keep your perception straight. I have very begrudgingly over the years, in my early years, came to believe, and finally I've believed it for many, many years, AA is really designed to do what alcohol does for me, except alcohol does it fast, and AA takes a long time and doesn't seem like you're eating anywhere because it's a very slow process. But AA is not to make me whole. AA is designed to take a person like me who never feels like I'm quite enough. And most of the time today, I feel like I'm enough. Not all the time. This used to bother me a lot. I'd read, kind of going to meetings and working with newcomers and giving of myself. Why do I feel like I'm enough all the time? And I had to come finally realize, no human being feels like they're enough all the time. That's a product of being a human being. It has nothing to do with being an alcoholic. You do these things and you feel like you're enough most of the time. It takes a person like me who's lived with fear all my life. I find myself in situations where people think I'm fearless. As some of you know, after a sober number of years, I worked in radio again and television and corporations. And finally, after 15 years, I found myself going down. For the last 22 years, I run the Midnight Mission on Skid Row, the place that threw me out in 1958. People say, why are you giving up your good, wonderful new career to run this stinking mission? And I couldn't think of a good answer. I finally told them, well, it was such a significant decrease in salary, I thought it was spiritual. But it wasn't. But sometimes, a couple of times in the last 3 or 4 years, I found myself going down alleys on Skid Row that the police do not choose to go down with a drawn gun. And I'm down there with my mouth to pull some son of a bitch out if I can. And I do it because they say, oh, Clancy, you're so fearless. It doesn't seem fearless to me. It just seems, I know how to do it. They don't. I'm not afraid. I walk through stubble where people refuse to walk. I'm not afraid to get out of there. And fearless? I know I'm not fearless. Tomorrow night, if I'm sitting in my living room in Los Angeles, my wife and I are sitting there, and if I would hear a strange noise in the backyard, I'd send her to see what it is. It might be a boogeyman. And everybody knows that boogeymen are more afraid of Al-Anons than AAs, that's all. Even boogeymen can't stand that cold smile coming out of the dark. You live your life and I'll live mine. Takes a person like me who feels rejection so strongly. I find myself today, I still feel rejected sometimes. I still have my feelings hurt. But I no longer think it's part of an international conspiracy to get me. I just realize that people and I sometimes see the same things from a different point of view. And if I can understand where they're coming from, I can do something about it. But this requires continual dialing to do these sort of things. And I'm lazy and I don't want to do them. That's why I go to meetings, to remind myself. It's kind of an interesting thing, you know, how lucky it is for you and me. There's already been a place like this for you and I to go for about 60 years. And up before that, there was no place to go. You gritted your teeth till you got drunk and died from it. And do you know why and nobody had a place to go. Nobody heard of sober alcoholics. Go to Healy Church and get drunk in a month, never any place to go. And just, you know, the first AA meetings in Cleveland, do you know why they held those meetings? It wasn't for the reason we hold them now. They held them so they'd have some place to take newcomers and prove there were other people staying sober. Because they had never seen anything like that. And little by little it's grown into a lot of therapeutics now. We go to meetings for many reasons, for sociable reasons and for the part of life reasons and understanding reasons and learning things. But it all boils down to this. When you go there and listen, you center. So I'm really glad. You know, people always say, I'm glad I've got my family back, and I'm glad I got a job, and I'm glad I'm doing well. These things have all happened to me. But that is what makes me glad. I'm glad that they were brought about because I finally stayed sober and allowed someone to superimpose actions over my judgments that enabled me to stay here long enough to discover that I was an alcoholic, much to my surprise. What a great blessing that is when you come to believe I'm an alcoholic. Then all of this makes sense. And I'm glad that I stayed here long enough to come to believe I don't have to return back to a Lutheran God that I look at it with the childlike eyes who I think is trying to kill me. I remember a few years ago, I was close to my parents again, taking my mother to the Norwich Lutheran Church in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and sitting there thinking, looking around and thinking how comfortable I was feeling, and thinking, my God, the same God is in this church as is in my meeting in West Los Angeles. I never would have guessed that. And I look around that church, and many of them sit like this, and I think, and they will never find out. To them, God hates them. I am so glad that I believe God loves me. No more than you, no less than you. I believe God loves us all. It's up to me to kind of grab it. And I am most grateful that I've overcome the terrible need to get even and to be fearless and to be wonderful. So I'm never going to be into these things. The best I can be is a human being who's trying to do it better. The best I can be is the man who pretends to be interested till he is interested. To take the actions whether or not I believe in it. And that's really what all of AA is about. It has many, many facets, but what AA is about for you and I to somehow find here something that will fill the holes that only alcohol has filled in your life and mine. Hopefully even to come to believe in a God that I can pray to. I didn't pray for a long time after I was sober. I couldn't possibly go to sleep now if I didn't pray earnestly to God. So I say, I don't know if it works, but I sleep better. That's all. The picture's clear. So I'm glad to be here tonight, and I'm glad to be safe and sane and sober.
I'm glad that Alcoholics Anonymous has enabled me to walk with a little degree of dignity, even though many times I fail. Many times I'm not anywhere near as peasant as I would like to be, and sometimes I'm childish and sometimes I'm emotional. But what I have is a place that enables me to try again. You know, in the thing we're talking to someone today about this, in 6 or 7 weeks, 8 weeks, we'll have New Year's Eve. And all over the world, people will make New Year's Eve resolutions. I will do better. I will not smoke. I will not drink. I will take better care of my children. I will do these things. Inevitably, sometimes the resolutions last for 3 days, sometimes a month, sometimes for a few weeks. The great thing about AA is this. For you and me, every night is New Year's Eve. And every day is New Year's morning. And if I fail today, I can try it again tomorrow. And get those shoulders back and that chin up. And try to be a little bit better than what I know I can be. And I will fail again and again. But thank God, that night is New Year's Eve. And I can give another shot. I'm glad to be with you. I hope that you stay here. You will find nothing better. God bless you. Thank you.